This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. And today we'll talk with Florida State University Law Professor Mary Ziegler on the continuing battle over Roe v. Wade, 45 years after the landmark U.S. Supreme Court decision. As the nation considers the legacy of the country's best-known Supreme Court decision, which was issued on January 22, 1973, Professor Ziegler says we've forgotten part of the story, one almost entirely disconnected from abortion. What does the right to privacy mean? Also, World Wrestling Entertainment Hall of Famer Jimmy Superstar Hart is scheduled to be with us to talk about WrestleMania coming to New Orleans in April and his long career in the profession. And if things go according to plan, we'll hear from Brooke Urich on websites offering companionship for so-called sugar daddies seeking sugar babies. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Ali Baltazar is producing, and your numbers are locally in the Baton Rouge area, 297-5633. Elsewhere, 877-217-5757. And send us an email if you so choose to talk@talklouisiana.org. We start with Mary Ziegler. She's a professor of law at Florida State University, and her research and teaching focus on the history and law governing the family, reproduction, gender, sexuality, employment, and torts. And her work, as far as her writing, is largely about the sensitive issue of abortion. And 10 days ago, we observed the 45th anniversary of the landmark Supreme Court decision Roe v. Wade, which legalized abortion in America. Dr. Ziegler is a graduate of Harvard Law School. Also, her undergraduate degree is from Harvard. And her latest work, is noted, is about this most sensitive topic, and it is one that people are passionate about on both sides, and we will give it our best shot as far as providing more light than heat. Her latest work is Beyond Abortion, Roe v. Wade and the Battle for Privacy. Good morning, Dr. Ziegler.
Morning, Jim.
As far as the issue of privacy, this is one that largely is not focused upon when people are talking about abortion, but you believe it's significant to the discussion. Why?
Well, in the 70s, after Roe was decided, people, and this was true actually of conservatives as well as progressives, thought that Roe was a decision not just about abortion, but about the right to privacy, which was actually the constitutional focus of the decision. And they thought that they could expand on this idea of privacy and use it in a bunch of creative ways in areas that had nothing to do with abortion. So what were some of these areas? Some of them were more closely related, like the laws governing sexual intimacy, and others really weren't. Some folks wanted to make Roe a decision about patients' rights to access either cheaper drugs or more unconventional treatments like alternative medicine. Other people wanted to make the right to privacy in Roe something that mattered to end-of-life decision-making. Others were interested in data privacy, the control over your personal information and how it gets used by the government, by law enforcement, by businesses. So they wanted to take the principle in Roe, which was, of course, related to abortion, and apply it much more broadly and create a right to privacy that would mean different things to different people. And I think that history has been lost, and that's too bad. It's also not an accident, because the people who are so passionate about the abortion issue worked pretty hard to make sure that we equate Roe with abortion and nothing more.
Here in Louisiana, Hope Medical Group for Women and its doctors are challenging the constitutionality of some measures that passed the legislature in 2016. One triples the waiting period for women seeking an abortion from 24 to 72 hours and requires doctors performing abortions to be board certified in obstetrics and gynecology or family medicine. Are these kinds of laws impeding the capacity for women to get abortions if they so choose?
Well, there are obviously two sides to this argument. And the question about whether the laws will be held constitutional is kind of a tricky one at the moment. I think it, probably if you want to know what the answer is going to be if these laws go to the Supreme Court, you're still probably going to be focused on what Justice Anthony Kennedy thinks, because he's the swing vote on abortion. The tricky thing, of course, is that there have been rumors swirling for some time that Kennedy is going to retire this June and would then be replaced in all likelihood by a nominee selected by President Donald Trump. And that nominee would probably be more sympathetic to regulations like the ones introduced in Louisiana. So the argument I think that a Trump nominee would make would be that these are reasonable health regulations that are designed to protect women from unqualified doctors or dangerous conditions. At least at the moment, that argument's a little hard to make because the Supreme Court's most recent abortion decision, which is called Full Women's Health versus Hellerstedt, required a lot of proof that a regulation benefited women and that those benefits were strong enough to outweigh whatever kind of burdens that were imposed on women's access to abortion. So it really would depend on how much evidence Louisiana has that these laws are needed to keep women safe.
We're talking with Dr. Mary Ziegler of Florida State University. Our latest work is Beyond Abortion, Roe v. Wade and the Battle for Privacy. Her first book was After Roe, The Lost History of the Abortion Debate. Before 1973, women were getting abortions in this country. How was it done prior to Roe v. Wade?
Well, it really depended on the state. So in some ways, nothing has changed. You know, whether and to what extent it's easy for women to get abortion depends now a lot on their zip code. And that was true before Roe as well. So in New York, for example, abortion was pretty much legal under every circumstance. And so it was not hard for women to get abortion. Because that was true, wealthier women could just travel to places where abortion was legal, whether that was within the United States or abroad. Poorer women, if they wanted to get abortions, often had to get illegal abortions, and the quality of illegal abortions, you know, varied pretty dramatically. There were some obvious instances of these abortions being performed by people who were not qualified to do it, and women suffered as a result. The rate of mortality in abortion was obviously much higher when abortion was illegal and at least in some circumstances, not supervised at all.
877-217-5757 is your number. We're talking with Dr. Mary Ziegler, Florida State University Professor of Law, and we're discussing the sensitive issue of abortion 45 years and 10 days after the Roe v. Wade decision. You noted that if Justice Kennedy leaves, he will likely be replaced by a more conservative justice. Neil Gorsuch was chosen last year, and he replaced Antonin Scalia. So Scalia was one of the most, if not the most, conservative justices on the court. So as far as that key fifth vote, Kennedy is crucial, isn't he?
He is, yeah. And he's also been, as he often is in most areas of the law, kind of a wild card when it comes to abortion. So he was the author of the opinion upholding a ban on partial birth abortion. And in that opinion, the author of some very strongly kind of fetal dignity, fetal rights language. And he was also the author of the opinion that retained and refused to overrule Roe v. Wade. So he's also someone, I think, whose views on abortion are fairly complicated and hard to predict. So as long as he stays on the court, the fate of laws like Louisiana's remain kind of still a little bit iffy, although obviously, as you pointed out, if he's replaced by someone more conservative, I think the answers become a lot clearer.
Senator Bill Cassidy of Louisiana distributed a press release just a couple of days ago on the 29th that says Cassidy urges colleagues to protect unborn babies who can feel pain. U.S. Senator Bill Cassidy spoke on the Senate floor and urged colleagues to vote in favor of the Pain Capable Unborn Child Protection Act, legislation he is co-sponsoring to protect, quote, unborn children from elective abortion at 20 weeks post-fertilization. What do you make of this kind of legislation? Is this chipping away at the edges of Roe v. Wade?
It is, yeah. So at least starting in about the 70s when pro-life people recognized that it wouldn't be possible to ban abortion outright anytime soon, pro-life lawyers and activists turned to a strategy I call incrementalism, or sort of chipping away. So the pain-capable laws pretty much try to build on one of the Supreme Court's most recent decisions, the partial birth abortion decision. They're quite similar, but they push a little further. So they're similar in the sense that they involve later term abortions. They're similar in the sense that they involve not just an interest in protecting life, but an interest in protecting things that are a little bit more intangible, like preventing pain or preserving dignity. And they're similar in the sense that they rely on kind of contested scientific findings. So in the partial birth abortion context, it was there was a fight about whether partial birth abortions were ever safer for women. In the pain-capable context, there's a fight about whether unborn children or fetuses are able to experience pain as early in pregnancy as proponents of the law say. So there's pretty much a playbook that people are following to kind of expand gradually on the restrictions that the Supreme Court has already signed off on.
Phil in Jefferson Terrace. Phil, you're on the air with Professor Mary Ziegler.
Good morning. My questions are these, that because of to educate people of when to know or understand how to keep from getting pregnant when someone doesn't want to, you would think that the education side of it would be something that is looked at or that is promoted. At what age do you think it's appropriate to start teaching our children how to prevent, how to do birth control? I think that would be one of the best ways to avoid abortions.
All right, we'll get Professor Ziegler's comments to your question, Phil, after this timeout. We're back with Talk Louisiana. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana, and we're going to spend a few more minutes with Dr. Mary Ziegler, professor of law at Florida State and author of Beyond Abortion, Roe v. Wade and the Battle for Privacy. And before we went to the break, Phil in Jefferson Terrace asked about education being a catalyst to preventing abortions. He asked what age would be appropriate. You've studied this issue from front to back, Dr. Ziegler. What do you think about the prudence of education?
I've always thought that that education could be something that people on either side of the abortion debate could kind of come together around. The sticky thing, of course, is parental rights, because when children should learn about sort of be involved in sex education is something that, of course, intersects with individuals' parents' decision-making about when that's appropriate. And that's not just true, you know, from my personal standpoint, that's also legally true, because parents have constitutional rights to direct the upbringing of their children. But I think definitely from the standpoint of reducing abortion, which is something that people who disagree about the morality or even legality of abortion should come together on, I think that finding ways of preventing pregnancy and therefore abortion is something that should be pursued. And I think that obviously, though, the problem that arises either when parents disagree about when sex education should begin or even what sex education should include. And we're, for better or worse, in a world where contraception's becoming more contested, as you can see from recent moves made by the Trump administration, and where the content of sex education is contested, too. For example, it should include abstinence-only programming or even exclusively include abstinence-only programming. So while I think this is an area that people should be able to find common ground on, it might, in fact, not be.
Is this an issue that's going to be with us for as long as we're alive? I can only imagine what would happen if Roe v. Wade were overturned. There would certainly be a pushback on that front.
I think it would be. I think even if you assume that there's a transformed Supreme Court that overrules Roe, you would essentially go back to a world where the matter was being fought out state by state, and a world where people who support abortion rights would be trying to transform the Supreme Court once again and reintroduce some sort of constitutional protection for abortion. So while I think it's possible to imagine that people would find solutions that would help women and make abortion less common, which it, in fact, has already happened. The abortion rate's been at historic lows year after year. The idea that there'll ever be political consensus on abortion, I'm afraid, is probably, I don't think that's ever going to happen, which sounds bleak, but I think it's true.
Now, I mentioned last week when we were talking about this, Dr. Ziegler, that in the history of the United States Senate, which is the body that approves Supreme Court justices, there have only been 51 women. That's in the history of the U.S. Senate. And there's 9 justices, 6 men, 3 women. Is that a fair representation when we're talking about an issue that affects women 100% and men 0% as far as actually having abortions?
Yeah, I mean, I think it would be desirable to have more women, not just for this reason, to be honest, both in Congress and on the Supreme Court. I don't know if that would necessarily mean that those bodies would become more sympathetic to the idea of legal abortion, because I'm sure, as you know, Jim, there are many leading pro-life figures who are women and historically have been leading proponents of abortion rights in Congress and even on the court who are men. But I do think that there's something to be said for women who understand the experience of pregnancy weighing in on this issue more often than they have in our kind of elite political institutions.
You have made this your life work as far as your writing and scholarly research. It's an issue that a lot of people shy away from. They don't like to talk about it. I would imagine you had to give some great thought to taking this path.
I have. I think that I'm a historian, so I get to be the kind of rational person in the room in a lot of these conversations. I've often done panels and other things where people on either side of the issue are arguing, and I'm asked to give perspective on how we got where we are or where we're going. And I always felt very strongly that we need people to assume that role, and that conversations about abortion sometimes need to be de-escalated. And at a minimum, that whatever you think about this issue, you need to kind of understand our history and understand how things got so polarized. Because if you don't understand that history, I think it's very hard to find a way forward to a better solution or a better future. So it's something I feel strongly about for that scholarly reasons and also personal reasons. I have pro-life and pro-choice people in my family.
Amanda at LSU, you are on the air with Dr. Ziegler. Hi, Amanda.
Hi, Dr. Ziegler. We're talking particularly about how Roe v. Wade kind of came up with this innovative idea of a right to privacy, which is really not sound historically, per se. Anytime that we establish rights legally, there's also a corresponding set of duties that citizens have. Where does that go specifically for women? Because in the United States, for instance, abortion, though there are restrictions in the second and third trimester, is basically available through every single moment of pregnancy. And every country except 6 in the entire world doesn't allow abortions after 20 weeks. And you could argue, based on the right of privacy, any woman shows after 20 weeks most of the time, it's now public knowledge that we have an interest in protecting a child that has a feasible life.
All right. Thank you, Amanda. Professor?
Yeah, Amanda makes an interesting point, because I think the court in Roe really didn't deal much with the right to privacy in its conventional sense, in the sense of there being a right and a duty that accompany one another. And one of the other, obviously, for that reason, interesting things about Roe was that people on either side of the aisle didn't think it was a very well-reasoned decision for that reason. I think in terms of duties, the way our law works now has kind of arrived at some kind of compromise, which means that no one likes it, either pro-life or pro-choice people, because it allows for a lot of the kinds of regulations that you outlined, Jim, things like waiting periods, informed consent periods, restrictions on later abortion. So the law, I think, in a way, has found some kind of back-end solution to create responsibilities that Roe itself did not. But as you can imagine, people who are pro-life think that those responsibilities or those restrictions don't go far enough, which is why this is an ongoing conversation.
Dan downtown. Dan, you'll be our final caller for Professor Mary Ziegler. Hi, Dan.
Hey, Dr. Ziegler, is the abortion issue part of the class warfare on privacy waged by the Republican Party? The rich can send their pregnant daughter to Sweden to avoid embarrassment, while the poor are left with a back-alley coat hanger.
There's definitely been always, I think, and still is a strong class dimension to the abortion debate, because the restrictions that I've been discussing disproportionately fall on poor women. There's ways, because you can always go to another state if you're wealthy to negotiate whatever solution you want if you have money, whereas if you're poor and you have to take time off of work and so on, a waiting period or some other law like that might effectively mean you don't get to have an abortion or you don't get to have an abortion mm-hmm. early in pregnancy. So these laws do have a strong class component, but that's always been true. I think this is something that the law can do very little to change, for better or worse. It was true before Roe. It was true after Roe, when abortion was less regulated than it is now, and it remains true today.
Tracy at the Capitol asks if there are any states where there are no facilities offering abortions for those who are seeking them.
As far as I know, there are a few states where there's one remaining abortion clinic, like Kentucky, for example. I don't know. I think there's litigation ongoing in all those states about whether they will have to close. Essentially, there have been laws passed in those states that would, if they were upheld, result in there being no abortion clinics, but that litigation is ongoing. So I don't think right now, unless I'm mm-hmm. a little behind, there are at least two that I'm aware of where there's only one.
Well, we thank you for joining us. Dr. Mary Ziegler from Florida State University, Harvard educated. Her latest book is Beyond Abortion, Roe v. Wade and the Battle for Privacy. Now the news on 89.3 WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Coming in just a bit, we'll hear from WWE Hall of Famer Jimmy Superstar Hart, but we're joined now by Brooke Urich. And she is involved with an interesting development in our world. There, believe it or not, a lot of so-called sugar daddies seeking sugar babies for companionship. And LSU and Tulane are among the leaders among college campuses. 360 young women at Tulane are apparently under this kind of arrangement, if you will, and 260 at Louisiana State University. And Brooke Urich, you're involved with as a spokesperson for a website that specializes in this sort of thing. And some people, I'm sure, find this amusing and others find it appalling. What's your take on the kind of service that you're offering?
Well, thanks so much for having me, Jim. And for people who don't know, SeekingArrangement.com is a dating website. It's a unique dating website that caters to people who are a little bit more honest about the time and money they want out of their relationships. So it's not usually a traditional progression towards marriage. It's more so finding someone who meets your needs now and who wants to have a relationship that might not be destined for kids and marriage.
Is this basically older men seeking younger women? Is that the kind of thing we're talking about?
Well, that kind of used to be the case, but on Seeking Arrangement, the average sugar daddy is 38, and the average sugar baby is 25. So the age disparity is not that much, and it's really more a site for people who want to build a relationship on their terms. So it's usually not someone who's using a traditional dating site because they're not finding what they're looking for.
I'm told that the average monthly stipend is $2,800. That's a lot of money for companionship. Is this automatically viewed as some kind of sexual arrangement between the parties?
No, I'm glad you brought that up, because that's a common misconception. We don't allow any sex work or illegal activity on Seeking Arrangement. What we do allow is people to list their lifestyle expectation, and that's that money that you were talking about. So a lifestyle expectation is the amount of money a sugar daddy would expect to spend on his relationship, and vice versa, it's the amount of money a sugar baby would expect to get spent on her, and that can be in the form of bills or tuition, books, maybe trips, dates, whatever it is that she needs, or he. There are also male sugar babies.
Now, there are male sugar babies as well?
Yes. So the site caters to LGBT. So there are gay male sugar babies. And then there are also straight male sugar babies. And we have a small pool of sugar mommies that I would like to see grow.
Mm-hmm. Now, are these occasionally married people seeking companionship outside the bounds of holy matrimony?
Some of the members on Seeking Arrangement are married. Some are separated. Some are widowed. Some are divorced. Some have kids. And most of them are not looking for the confines of a traditional relationship. They're probably not looking to leave their wife or to get remarried. And on the converse, a sugar baby isn't looking to split up your marriage. Sugar babies also don't want a traditional relationship. They're usually in university. They're getting their lives started. They don't want to settle down, but they do want to date someone who's qualified.
Well, I mentioned, according to your figures, 260 sugar babies at LSU, 360 at Tulane University, and many other schools, I'm sure, have sugar babies. This is a nationwide phenomenon, isn't it?
It really is. In about 2010, we noticed a lot of students joining the website, probably due to the recession and them graduating and not being able to get jobs. And we decided to start offering students a free premium membership for Seeking Arrangement. So student sugar babies who use their university email addresses can get that membership, and then we're able to tell which schools they're coming from.
Do you view this as a bit cheesy?
I think it's more honest than a lot of other dating sites. Is it for everyone? No. SeekingArrangement.com is for adults who want this lifestyle and who are probably living this lifestyle before Seeking Arrangement was even around.
Are there pockets in the country where there are more participants? For example, in the South, do we have more or less? How's that work?
The membership on Seeking Arrangement is usually largest where the larger city populations are. So New York is our top, then LA, and the United States is our largest country. Canada is actually second, and then the UK. So it's a worldwide phenomenon, and it's growing exponentially as people become more accepting of these lifestyles. And also as more people join, they tell their friends. That's actually the number one way we get new people signing up is through a word of mouth referral.
Well, we thank you for joining us. It's obviously an interesting topic, and as long as we have people who are sexually active and even those who are not, we often need companions in our world, and this is one way to do it. Thank you, Brooke Urich.
Thanks for having me.
It's good to talk with you. We're joined now in studio by the fabulous WWE Hall of Famer, Jimmy Superstar Hart, the mouth of
the South. How you doing, baby? It's all great, man. Back in New Orleans again. It's going to be awesome, man. April the 8th. Is our big day, WrestleMania 34.
34 years. You were there on the ground floor, weren't you?
You know what? I was so blessed. Madison Square Garden, WrestleMania 1, 34 years ago, and I was lucky enough to be part of that.
Wrestling pro wrestling has always had an audience, and it seems that it has grown exponentially. Why has it become so popular among people who years past would have frowned on this kind of spectacle?
Well, it's got something for everybody. You know, doctors, lawyers, attorneys, you know, everybody. But your families, your grandmothers watched it, and your grandfathers watched it, and their grandfathers and their grandmothers watched it, too. And now it's just, it seems like the whole world's watching. You know, it's great entertainment on Monday nights. We have our Raw show. We have our SmackDown show on Tuesday nights and our pay-per-views once a month, of course. And, you know, just to make a long story short, it's really crazy, but they were in Philadelphia this past week for the Royal Rumble. 4 days in Philadelphia, every night sold out. What else event can take place like that that's going to sell out 4 days in a row, 15, 16,000 people a night?
Well, over the past 10 years, WrestleMania has generated nearly $1 billion in economic impact for its host cities, and New Orleans is the city for WrestleMania 34. Jimmy Superstar Hart was part of WrestleMania 1 Madison Square Garden, 1985.
You know what? I went to the ring with Greg the Hammer Valentine, came back, changed my jacket, and went to the ring with King Kong Bundy, who beat S.G. Jones in about 16 seconds. So to this day, people always ask me, you know, what's the most important part of your life in the wrestling business? You know, I managed Andy Coppin back in our Memphis days. That was great. Being inducted in the Hall of Fame was awesome. But still being part of WrestleMania 1 was still the most important thing to me, because if it hadn't been successful, we wouldn't sit here doing your radio show now.
I recall Andy Kaufman getting the you-know-what beaten out of
Lawler.
Him by Jerry Lawler.
Yes. David Letterman show, it sure was.
Well, and we used to have a wrestling promoter here in Baton Rouge, Jimmy Killshaw, and he said, Jim, never get in the ring with a pro. Andy made that mistake.
He sure did.
877-217-5757. Tom in Woodland Ridge, you're on with Jimmy Superstar Hart, WWE Hall of Famer.
Mouth of the South. How you doing, Jimmy?
Man, I'm doing great. Great to hear from you.
Great. Quick question for you. I know that you have in the past been closely associated with Hulk Hogan. How do you feel about the current WWE stance regarding Hogan, and do you think that in the future that their position might change?
Well, you know what? Nothing ever lasts forever, and that's one good thing about the professional wrestling business, especially the WWE. You know, never say never on anything. You know, Goldberg came back this past year. The Ultimate Warrior got to come back this past a couple of years back and everything else. So, you know, you just never know what the future holds for anything or anybody.
Thank you, Tom. Last year's WrestleMania, by the way, saw fans come from 50 states and 62 countries, so it has become an amazing spectacle in our country. And the 2018 WWE Hall of Fame ceremony will take place the Friday before WrestleMania at the Smoothie King Center on April 6th. Now, New Orleans seems to be just the right kind of place for this sort of thing.
You know, Jim, you're absolutely right. This is our second appearance back here, which is going to be unbelievable. We've got so much great things going on. We've got WrestleMania Access, which is going to – well, tickets go on sale this Saturday, okay? Mm-hmm. And at 10 a.m., Ticketmaster locations, check it all out. But like I said, when you see WrestleMania Access, you've got the NXT matches are going to be there for part of that. We've got all kind of memorabilia the fans get to come and see, and you get a close look up and personal of your superstars too, the women and the men. So it's just going to be a great activity.
David in Atlanta. Hello, David. You're on the air with Jimmy Superstar Hart.
Mr. Hart, it's an honor to have an audience with you. For many years of great entertainment, I'd like to thank you. And I think the Hart Foundation, just like the Dudleys are going into the Hall of Fame, I think the Hart Foundation, if they're not already there, needs to be inducted. And I'd like to ask you a question. I remember when the Human Condominium, King Kong Bundy was carrying you around on that evening show, TNT, with the great Gorilla Monsoon and Bobby the Brain. Those Gorilla and Bobby the Brain were sensational entertainers. They were the best announcing and color team in the history of wrestling. Do you have any interesting stories to tell us about those great gentlemen?
Well, you know what? There's so many great stories, but I was telling Joe, the gentleman from WWE that's with us on this tour, and I said, you know, it was so amazing to walk into any dressing room back in our era, and over on the left you have Andre the Giant playing cards. You have the Honky Tonk Man in one corner tuning his guitar. Jake the Snake Roberts feeding Damien. You had the British Bulldogs over there with Matilda. Nikolai Volkoff and the Iron Sheik rehearsing mm-hmm. the Russian national anthem. And it was such a thrill to me to be part of that. But, you know, we've had some great commentators back in the day. You know, Vince McMahon was tremendous. Jesse the Body. You know, just so many of them were just so good. And it was so great to be with Bobby all the time. You know, Bobby was always telling jokes and keeping everybody lively in the dressing rooms and everything. And one good thing about this WrestleMania Access, you're going to see a lot of the great memorabilia from some of the stars of the past, like Andre the Giant, Bobby the Brain Heenan, even the Mouth of the South, Jimmy Hart.
We'll be back after this pause with more of Jimmy Hart. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Jimmy Superstar Hart is with us, the Mouth of the South. Throughout his illustrious career, he's managed some of the biggest names in pro wrestling, including Hulk Hogan, the Hart Foundation, and Greg the Hammer Valentine. He mentioned Andy Kaufman, but Jimmy was part of WrestleMania 1 at Madison Square Garden 33 years ago, and now WrestleMania 34 will be taking place Sunday, April 8th, Mercedes-Benz Superdome, New Orleans. and it is going to be quite a spectacle. Who are some of those who will be participating in WrestleMania 34?
Well, first of all, one great thing that's going to take place is, of course, you know, we have a Hall of Fame each year, of course, and Goldberg just got inducted into the new Hall of Fame. Well, it's going to be inducted into it, along with the Dudley Boys, just to mention a few. And, of course, you know, you'll see all the superstars. You know, John Cena's going to be there. You're going to see some of the brand-new up-and-coming young talent like AJ Styles. And it's just going to be a variety for everybody. And, you know, they're pushing the women really hard right now. You know, they just had the first Women's Royal Rumble that just took place in Philadelphia this past weekend. So you're going to have a lot of up-and-coming superstar lady wrestlers that are going to be there for that, too. So there's something for everybody.
What do you think it is that attracts people to professional wrestling?
The excitement. And I think deep down inside, probably 90% of the people out there, male or female, has always wanted to try to get into the ring. You know, and people look and go, I can do that. Mm-hmm. You know, I can have the glitter, the glamour, the lights, and you know, and just get in that ring and let thousands and thousands of people watch me every week and go out and sign autographs and just make a ton of money, you know. But it's just something special.
Is it fake?
It's predetermined, you know. People always ask me about that UFC. They go, Jimmy, that UFC, that looks fake and phony. And I said, I don't know. I don't want to try any of it, you know. But I just said, no, but it's predetermined, which we let everybody know that. And, you know, it's so funny. Since we've told everybody that it's WWE World Wrestling Entertainment, our crowds are bigger, merchandise sells more, and more and more people watch each and every week.
All right. A listener notes that Donald Trump got involved in WrestleMania a few years back.
Yeah, the president. Yeah, he was in one of our WrestleManias. He did a great job.
He threw down Vince McMahon, didn't he?
Threw down Vince McMahon and did a great job. And he was so great to work with there, too. He was so kind to everybody, took pictures with everybody, autographs, and he sure did. He was great.
This is how he says he actually cut McMahon's hair off. Is that correct?
He sure did. One of the stipulations in the match was a hair match, and Donald Trump got his hand raised. But, you know, Vince, you know, whatever it takes, buddy, he got his head shaved. He sure did.
My goodness. Well, we will see, I'm sure, some festive activity and some action in the ring. There's no doubt that, I've actually interviewed some of these people in locker rooms. There is some physical activity. These guys are athletes, and they do it many times a year.
Well, you know, you're right. You know, Raw's on every Monday night. SmackDown's on Tuesday nights. The pay-per-views are once a month, of course. And, of course, there's your house shows that take place 7 days a week. So you really got to be in great shape and a great athlete to perform. And also, that's what I said before. This is what's so good about WrestleMania. It's a week of festivities, of course. And our tickets go on sale Saturday for WrestleMania Access, you know, which is you're going to see so many great things, you know, starting at 10 o'clock this Saturday, tickets go on sale. You've got the Hall of Fame. And, of course, for WrestleMania Access, you've got so many things the kids can do. You get to watch the NXT matches. You turn around and see all kind of great memorabilia, past, present, and future, a chance to get up and close personal with your superstars, the girls and the guys. And so it's a chance to get your autographs and pictures made with them. It's just a whole week of fun.
All right, well, you got involved in this in an unusual way, didn't you?
I sure did. You know, I came from a musical background. I was part of a group called the Gentrys. We had a million-seller record back in 1960s, 65, called Keep On Dancing. We did all the tours with Dick Clark and the Beach Boys and Sonny and Cher. And I went to school with Jerry the King Lawler. He went into wrestling. I went into music. And for some reason, don't ask me why, but everybody in music wants to be in wrestling, and everybody in wrestling wants to be in music. So I helped him do a wrestling album. And the next thing you know, I had the phone call from Vince McMahon in New York City, and it was Feet Don't Fail Me Now, and I was on my way to New York.
You're a natural performer.
I don't know about that, but I love what I'm doing. I figure in life, if you're going to do something, you might as well love it. And so that's been my whole life. You know, I've never really had a plan for anything. I've never had a plan for the music. Out of high school, we were lucky enough to cut the million-seller record with MGM Records and tour with Dick Clark. I didn't know what I was going to do after that, and all of a sudden I was in the crazy world of professional wrestling in Memphis for 6 years, and I had the magic phone call, and I went to New York.
These people are not stupid people. The ones I've interviewed, and I can, you know, Cowboy Bill Watts, Jesse Ventura many times, who was governor of Minnesota, Ernie Ladd, who was on this show many times before he passed away, Dusty Rhodes, there have been a number. All of them were impressive people as far as their ability to talk, and talking is a big part of pro wrestling, isn't it?
You know what? I think talking is so much a big part of anything. You know, look at Muhammad Ali. You know, why did he stand out other than maybe Joe Frazier, you know? Because Muhammad Ali, he had the gift of gab. And I think in life, you know, it's like your radio show here. I was just listening to you do an interview with a young lady a while ago. You do a great job. I mean, you're just like it, so easy going, man. You know, you had your little paperwork over here. But everything you said just really flowed and made sense when you were talking to her. I think everybody's got something special about them, but it's still a personality-driven business.
What are some of the best venues that you have been to?
Some of the best what?
Venues.
Venues. Oh, well, I used to love the Philadelphia Spectrum, of course, Madison Square Garden, the Coliseum in Memphis, of course, where we started was so much history there. But it just seems like all the cities now, the arenas are getting so much bigger, you know, 15, 16, 17,000 people. And the fans everywhere, wrestling fans are very, very special. You know, when you go to the in Philadelphia, those fans are very rowdy, but they really love what they love, and they don't like what they don't like, you know. And you got to give them what they want. If you don't, you're in a heck of a lot of trouble. Madison Square Garden, great, you know. And it's just wrestling fans are just so cool everywhere.
877-217-5757 or talk at talklouisiana.org. In our remaining time with Jimmy Superstar Hart, the mouth of the South, Rachel asks about you penning songs for some wrestlers. Have you done that?
Oh, I sure have. Well, thank you, Rachel, for saying that. But let me tell you, I was so lucky, like I said, being part of the Gentrys. But when I went to New York, I met a guy named Dave Wolf, who was Cyndi Lauper's manager. And he, along with Dick Clark, he was producing a wrestling album. So I penned a little song called Eat Your Heart Out, Rick Springfield. And so that turned out to be well enough that Vince and them asked me to cut some more stuff for some of the wrestlers. And we wrote Sexy Boy by Shawn Michaels, The American Dream by Dusty Rhodes, the Road Warriors theme song, the Hart Foundation theme song, Jimmy Superfly Snuka. The list just went on, and the Honky Tonk Man's greatest hits, A Hunk of Hunk of Honky Love, our big one. And so, like I said, we've been blessed doing what we've loved doing for so many years.
All right. Tim asked, did you know Andre the Giant?
Oh, I loved Andre the Giant. Quick story on Andre. You know, back in our day, we were doing so many interviews on the road. Whatever hotel we might be at, our camera could come out, and we'd set up doing our interviews. Well, in between interviews, you know, Andre would like to go to the local, you know, the bar inside and have a little beer or two or a glass of wine. But he didn't like to drink alone. Well, I didn't drink at all. So if he would catch you walking through the lobby, he'd go, Jimmy, and I'd go, hey, Andre, and I'd go sit with him, and we might say a word to each other every 10 minutes, you know, like, let's look good. Right, Andre? And I'd wait till I see Bobby the Brain coming through or somebody, and I'd go, hey, come here, Bobby. Andre, won't you? Then I'd jump out, and I'd leave, and then Bobby'd be stuck. Then later on that night, Bobby'd go, I'm going to get you for that. But Andre was awesome. He was just great.
He was like 500 pounds.
Oh, he was unbelievable.
And he could drink, I understand, a whole lot of alcohol and
he
not
did.
Show
he loved
it.
He loved his wine, but such a wonderful, wonderful person.
You've met some characters along the way, haven't you?
Boy, I have.
Who are the most memorable?
Junkyard Dog. I love doing programs with Junkyard Dog. You know, he was so great. And, of course, in Memphis, Andy Kaufman, of course, and Jerry Lawler. But up in New York, you know, we've been blessed to meet so many celebrities by doing what we do. You know, from Wayne Gretzky to Pete Rose to, you know, Muhammad Ali, of course, to Dick Clark, Liberace, you know. It's just, it's, you know, it's been such a great run for me. Sometimes I pinch myself and go, did I really get paid for doing this my whole life?
I recall as a kid in Little Rock, I went to a pro wrestling event, and it was refereed by Joe Louis.
Oh, my gosh.
The Brown Bomber.
Oh, my gosh.
Joe Louis.
Unbelievable. Unbelievable. Don't you wish you'd have kept your program?
Yeah, I do. But I thought it was only 20 years removed from him being heavyweight champion of the world. So
Lord have mercy.
He gave it his all. He was a performer too, as are you. And you don't appear to be slowing down at all.
Well, you know what? Once again, if you love doing what you're doing, you know, it's not like work. And like I said, the WWE has such a great crew that goes with us on the road, and everybody's so professional. And it's just, like I said, I've been blessed to be doing this. I pinch myself and look in the mirror every day and go, did I really get paid for doing this my whole life? It's been great. And the fans keep you young again, too, you know. When we go out and they tell the stories, Jimmy, we saw you in the Hart Foundation back in the Spectrum, or we saw you in the Nasty Boys do this. And it's just a wonderful thing.
Well, I have seen some of the same people who go to the Symphony also go to pro wrestling matches. And Jimmy, you're one who is evident of the fact that you can be a Renaissance man and be involved in professional wrestling at the highest levels.
And we had one hit wonder, but I guess it's better to have one hit than no hits, right?
Well, good luck. It's April 8th.
April the 8th, yes, sir.
WrestleMania 34 at the Superdome in New Orleans. The Governor John Bel Edwards is all charged up about this because he knows the economic input that WrestleMania will have on the state of Louisiana.
Yeah, the governor's great. You know, hopefully he's going to be at a WrestleMania access. Like I said, tickets go on sale this Saturday.
Thank you, Jimmy. Superstar Hart, the mouth of the South. We're back tomorrow, same time, same place. For Ali Baltazar, I'm Jim Inkster. Thanks for listening and stay tuned.
For a podcast of today's show, go to WRKF.org or find the Talk Louisiana podcast on the WRKF app. We welcome your feedback and topic suggestions. Email us at talk@talklouisiana.org. Talk Louisiana is a production of WRKF in Baton Rouge.